Hi, Alistair.
Morning, everyone. I'll just, oh, morning, afternoon, rather, ahead of myself. If everyone could just make sure that they're on mute, if possible, we will start in just a couple of minutes' time. Give it a couple more minutes for everyone to join. And I'll just give it one more minute. So I think we'll go ahead and get started. So welcome everyone to the Graduate Recruiters Network's Great Debate. We will be discussing managing intergenerational differences in the workplace today. We are joined by Dr. Arlene Egan, who I'll introduce to you all shortly. Just a couple of housekeeping bits. We are recording today, so if you would like to remain off screen, please do turn off your camera. And if you could all make sure you're on mute, that would be amazing. You can utilize the chat function on Teams. Dan Hawes will be monitoring this throughout for any additional questions. Before we get onto the topic, it's good to take a look at who is joining us today. So as you'll see, we have a number of acquisition advisors, HR leads, careers consultants, and many more from businesses of all sizes across a number of different sectors, a few of which you'll see at the bottom of the screen here, you may recognize. You're all in the right place, so that's a start. For those of you that might be new to Graduate Recruiters Network, a little run through an introduction about us and what we do. We've been running since 2009, bringing together early talent, careers leads, HR advisors, with the emphasis on members sharing best practice in a confidential environment. We've got just shy of 4,000 members, seven of which are new in the last month. We work with a number of FTSE 100, Fortune 500, and fast-growing firms across all sectors. And members of our Graduate Recruiters Network can benefit from invites to webinars, in-person events, which you'll hear more about later, the LinkedIn forum, WhatsApp group, and many more. We do also have a VIP membership, which you can find out more about if you just pop myself or Dan a message. A little bit more about me. You've probably not met me yet. I've been here for a few months, loving the industry. I'm new to it, but learning very, very quickly. I graduated in 2020 with a first class honours degree in journalism and media studies. I've got a wealth of experience in copywriting, strategy, and creating engaging marketing campaigns and brand development. I currently head up our advertising and attraction for our RPO division, and I work with clients like Bank of America, Brit Insurance, Renishaw, Police Now, and Unlocked. So why managing intergenerational differences? We have had a number of questions from members, and we've seen it in, well, some of the headlines that you can see on the screen here, namely Forbes, HR News, and the Harvard Business Review. There's been a lot of industry-wide coverage about the challenges that a lot of businesses are facing with the five generations in the workplace. So many of you have submitted questions. We'll be working through some of those today, but please do feel free to pop any in the chat. As I mentioned earlier, Dan Hawes will be monitoring that quite closely. So do just pop anything in there. If we don't have time to make it through everything today, which I'm sure we won't, it's a very, very broad topic. Dr. Arlene Egan has confirmed that she will be available through our LinkedIn Graduate Recruiters Network forum for any additional questions that you might have within the next kind of 24 hours following. We know it can get your brain ticking, so please do let us know if there's anything that you feel we've missed. So I'd like to formally introduce you to Dr. Arlene Egan. With over 25 years of experience in leadership management and development, Arlene has worked with boards, C-suites and leadership teams to identify the right learning environment to promote an engaging and development kind of area. With a particular passion for learning, leadership and transformation, Arlene is an active researcher in this field. So there's no one better really for us to speak to than Arlene for this. We have identified three kind of key themes. Like I said, this is a very broad topic, so we will be working to these three key themes today. But as I mentioned, any additional spaces that you feel haven't been covered, we can pick up on afterwards. We'll be covering equity, diversity and inclusion, and the links to intergenerational differences, challenges managing intergenerational differences, particularly from kind of a management and leadership perspective, and the impact of hybrid working on intergenerational differences. So without further ado, I'm going to stop sharing my screen and we're going to open the questions to Arlene. So one of the first questions that we have that I think is probably a really good starting point is from Victoria from Lloyds Banking Group, and they asked, typically intergenerational differences are seen as a blocker and cause friction. How do you recommend we change this narrative to enable colleagues to appreciate the benefits different experiences and perspectives can offer?
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And it's lovely to be here with you this afternoon. So thank you for having me. And this is, you know, such a powerful topic for organizations as well. So great question. And I suppose the first thing to think about is that difference is always hard in organizations. So, you know, anybody that's in ED&I, anybody that's driving these agendas, you know, even the fact, if we can call the elephant in the room, really ED&I shouldn't be owned by one person in an organization or a team. It should actually be a way. It should be, you know, it should be an approach that an organization has, rather than the responsibility or accountable to a particular team. So when we think about the blockers, sometimes it has to start off with, how open is your organization really to, you know, understanding what this difference is in terms of where we might need to work harder in order to work differently, but also to understand the benefits. And it's not just now that we're talking about the benefits of diversity on a team. When innovation, a number of years back, when innovation was the buzzword, you know, there was so much information, so many studies done on the power of diversity and trying to challenge thinking. A lot of organizational success, as we know, will come from where climate and culture is being led. And often the strongest influencer for that is at the top. So, you know, if we can see, and we've all seen cases, I'm sure, where hires look very similar in terms of demographics and across so many demographics. And, you know, traditionally, people at particular generation, particular stages of their career, it's been harder for them to get jobs, whether that's starting off in career, early career, or whether that's later career. You know, there's biases that we're dealing with all the time. So in terms of the blockers, really, the first thing to do is to understand what actually those blockers are. What are we dealing with? Is it old school leadership teams? Is it cognitive biases and assumptions that we hold? Is it a lack of energy and enthusiasm to be able to actually deal with this difference and to really understand how we can maximize it? So, you know, in terms of changing the narrative, so first of all, we'd always say, understand what the real challenge is, understand what the real problem is, and then work to see what kinds of solutions can be generated. In terms of changing the narrative, you know, we always look to evidence, right? So, you know, what organizations are out there that are doing this really well? You know, who is the leader in this space? And again, depending on the industry that you find yourself in, you know, you might be aware of people within your industry doing this very well, or initiatives that are going on in your industry to do this very well. And if not in your industry, then, you know, how do you become a leader in your industry? Where else can you look to see? At the end of the day, business for most of us is people. And every organization is dealing with people, you know, so to some degree. So, you know, there are people, there are organizations that are taking this extremely seriously, from, you know, the employee value proposition that they put out into the world, the stories they tell themselves, and the lived experience that people have when they join those organizations. So these stories are being shared more often. So it's easier to get, you know, stories of data, but really understanding the value that a narrative around openness, diversity to different generations, as well as, of course, the ED&I agenda across the board. Now, this is a really good starting point, but really, I'd say step one, understand the problem. What's the issue that you're dealing with? And then it's easier to find that solution, because you're going to have different blockers or different types of blockers in different organizations.
Yeah. And I think a lot of those, naturally, from the reading that I've done and the research on this topic, there's quite a lot of kind of mentions of stereotypes, and how those stereotypes really are kind of at the core of the kind of blocker of communication, I guess. Communication is absolutely everything. And if we don't know or understand each other's communication forms, that obviously causes a bigger issue. There is a lot of questions and a lot of talk in the media about reverse mentoring. What's your take on reverse mentoring, Arlene?
Reverse mentoring can be an extremely powerful tool. It can also be an extremely cost-effective tool. So for organizations that don't have high budgets for learning and development, or, you know, different kinds of development programs, reverse mentoring is something to consider. In terms of doing reverse mentoring right, you really need to understand how people can help each other across the organization. And for anyone who's unfamiliar, we're already assuming that everybody knows about this. Really, it's about when we mentor backwards. So when you take somebody, in this case, you take somebody at a later stage of their career, and somebody at an earlier stage of the career, and that later stage person is learning skills from that younger person. Now, when you say it, and when you think about the potential power of this method of learning, you know, if we know, you know, this is the industry I'm in, we know nobody ever remembers what was on slide 6 of a development program, right? That's just not how learning works. Yeah. We know that learning happens through relationships, through stories, through experiences, and through interactions. So imagine the power of somebody whose early career, maybe new into that career, helping change the work practices of somebody who's got so much experience in other parts of their work, to really make a difference to that person. But it doesn't just go that way. When reverse mentoring becomes part of the culture of an organization, the value of that initiative can be seen at all levels, because you're breaking down barriers, not only from a learning and development perspective, a skills and performance perspective. You're breaking down barriers in relationships. You're having different generations have different kinds of conversations, and ultimately finding out where there's potentially more common ground than there might be difference. And again, a lot of, you know, I'm sure I don't have to tell most of the people on this call, because this is your life, but, you know, whenever you're dealing with talent, a lot of work is done to try to help people understand how we share a common goal, what we all bring to this common goal. And again, reverse mentoring, you know, I've seen it really, really powerfully done across a lot of different organizations. So I used to work in animation. I used to head up an animation, the L&D function for an animation studio. And, you know, when the younger artists would come in with different techniques, little hacks, we probably call them now, for, you know, getting things done, and being able to share this with more seasoned artists who, you know, are such, like, their craft is, you know, it's unbelievable.
Incredible.
There's
yeah.
still something to learn. There's still something to learn. And again, you know, across the board, we can see impact. when it's done well. It does need to be done well. And the word of caution I would say is when I've seen this not done well is because people really haven't bought into the value of the skill set that people, you know, that they're trying to mentor on. So it's very, very important you have willing mentees and mentors in this situation, as you would in any other situation.
Yeah, I think setting purpose is always good for actually achieving what you set out to do. I guess we all need it to remind us why we're doing what we're doing. So I think some of the similar questions that have kind of come off of that are particularly about retaining junior staff. So in terms of age diversity within teams, how important is that, would you say, to retaining junior staff?
Interesting. The retention of junior staff now, there's a lot of variables potentially at play. Okay, yeah. So the makeup of the team that they're on may be one aspect. You know, if we also know that there's different trends in how people are working and there's different expectations that people have coming into roles now. So, you know, if we understand, and again, international research would suggest that if we were to look at generational categories, we see the likes of Generation Z wanting much more of a portfolio career. Now, is an organization breaking their back to try to keep these people who already have their roadmaps laid out, their, you know, 5, 10, 15 year goals planned out? Probably not. So the best thing that they can do, any organization can do in terms of retention, is to really help to understand how those people can leave your organization absolutely flourishing. So they tell their friends about your organization and, you know, you're able to keep that pipeline going. So in some aspects, organizations don't have control over how long junior talent is going to stay. In other times, when we think about the culture and the climate that people are joining, you know, there was that saying, and it's still true to many, many degrees, that people don't leave a job, they often leave their manager, or they leave the culture that they're finding themselves in. And so, you know, there is a lot of emphasis, there's a lot of focus, and companies that aren't paying attention to company culture for all of their staff, they're going to be the ones really struggling. So when we think about junior talent, we think about team, it comes back to how much of a sense of belonging do those employees feel? Do those people feel? Yeah. How welcome are they made? How much, you know, in terms of empowerment or that ability to bring their skill set and to use their skill set on the team? So, you know, across the board, what we find in organizations that we work with is when we get the basics right in an organization, and that's communication, that's respect, you know, that's giving people autonomy and agency. When we get that right at every level, we see positive performance, and we see loyalty, if you want to call it that. We see people bringing their best. So, you know, again, it's not always about age differentiation or demographics. You know, people like to find people they can talk to and that they can relate to. You know, so even in Roffey Park Institute, some of our more recent hires have been, you know, in the early 20s age group, and where most of us are between 40 and 55, you know. So it's like, gosh, who can they talk to? You know, who can they, you know, what's their outlets? You know, what are we providing for people across the board? You know, what is the organization doing to make sure that they have a sense of belonging above and beyond just getting the work done, or that they feel part of a team? So when we're thinking about, you know, within a team, what might it be like to join a team that doesn't have a lot of diversity in terms of age profile? You know, that can be tricky, right? The same kind of complications can be said when it's a massively diverse spread of ages, you know. So again, it's always thinking about, you know, the individuals coming into teams. What as a manager, what as a leader, what as a HR recruiter or somebody within the talent space, what does this person need to help them to fit into this organization, to help them to belong, to help them to feel part of it? And so again, you know, you might see things like buddying. You know, it's quite common where, you know, people can work together just to have somebody to go, oh my God, that was a tough week, or oh my God, what happens here, or oh my God, where are the pens kept? You know, but somebody that you can talk to that relates to you. So, you know, just again, thinking, you know, I can go back to my own organization. You know, it's traditionally an older generation organization. We're starting to recruit younger, and we have to think about this. You know, we have to go, well, you know, It's just, it's not the same. We have to think differently, and we can't assume that the culture that has existed for the past 76 years in Roffey Park Institute is the culture it needs to be for the next generation coming in. Otherwise, we're not going to feed the pipeline. You know, we're just not going to get the staff.
Absolutely. And it's all about kind of remaining open to changes and to kind of new suggestions, but also coming back to exactly what it is that kind of instills those values in the first place and what drives the company culture and makes it what it is among the people that have been there for so long. Because exactly. There are definitely benefits in that too.
For sure. And even, you know, like certainly the work we're doing with organizations around their cultures right now, because, you know, what got you here might not get you there, you know. So, you know, what do we know about those generations that are coming in, or generations across the board that we're trying to attract in? You know, so we're not just talking about bringing in, you know, new talents and bringing in people from younger generations across the board. What do people, you know, COVID was a big smack in the face for many organizations to actually say, stop and look at what you're doing, because you can't keep doing this. And the organizations that were already, you know, hybrid or blended, you know, sometimes I have conversations with those, and they, you know, leaders in those organizations, they look at me and they go, this isn't such a big deal. Like, we were doing this well way before COVID happened, you know. And yet there's a panic that, you know, oh, we're not doing this right. Whereas there's so many case studies out there of people that are getting this right day to day. So, you know, the answers exist, but we have to be willing in our roles to actually potentially look outside our organization, look outside our industry in order to learn what we should be doing.
Yeah, completely agree. I mean, we have a good question here that seems like a kind of natural lead on from the conversations that we had so far. So Andrew from King's College in London asked, whose responsibility is it to help future graduates manage intergenerational differences? Their local team, senior leadership of the organisation, the individual, or should they be prepped at earlier stages for working environments from places like their universities or colleges?
I love this question. I love this question because this question has to be not only asked, but this question has to be answered once and for all. I mean, how many years have people been talking about the gap from university into the workplace? Okay.
Absolutely.
So when we, you know, start to answer this question, I think that responsibility lies in multiple places.
Yeah.
For sure. So there's no one silver bullet for this. There's no one clear answer. However, there are brilliant opportunities now to put together programs, workplace readiness programs, you know, that potentially are done with universities, but by, you know, private sector, public sector organizations.
Yeah.
So creating proper partnerships to bridge that gap. However, what we also know about generations coming out of university, again across the globe, is that there's a tendency for these generations to be involved in more than just their studies. So some of them are in charities, in committees, in teams, where they're getting exposure to different generations already, but just in different contexts. So, you know, there's a lot of richness already coming out, you know, because we're seeing this again. You know, kind of this interest and passion to be part of more than just university, be part of more than just a workplace. So again, the moment is here where these future employees or these employees we're getting ready for organizations, they have a lot of answers themselves. They know what they need in terms of help. It's just, we need organizations that are brave enough, and institutions, academic institutions, are brave enough to go, okay, let's try something in this space. Let's stop talking about it and let's try something.
Yeah.
And yet, I know there are initiatives, you know, and I'm absolutely not taking away from that, but this needs to be a very conscious effort because, you know, as workplaces are changing with flexibility still being a key driver, you know, how people belong to an organization if it's hybrid, how people belong to an organization if there's a lot of remote working. There are different skill sets required, and why wouldn't we help in that? So I would see that responsibility for that. You know, I think that industry and education need to talk much more seriously and more urgently about this. And genuinely, you know, I know of one organization that's talking to us about this. So I, you know, I can start to see things moving. but something has to actually happen. It's not just talk.
Yeah,
and it's also helping the students moving into that employment phase. It's helping them to understand what they're actually bringing with them already. Because sometimes until you're in the context, you don't know how to use your skill set. You don't know how you don't know the value of the toolkit that you have. So, some of it is just helping in that case. And again, who's best placed for that? HR, talent, OD, they're an amazing skill set in helping people realize their own potential in that space. You've got career coaching, I don't think we're short of the expertise. It's the drive to put the initiative in place. And it's the understanding of the value that will bring to the organizations as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, we attended the ISE launch of the survey that they do annually, I think earlier this week, and there were some fantastic insights. I mean, namely, one of them that's particularly relevant to what you've just mentioned is that there is a significant uptake that happened kind of this year and that is forecasted for the next year with regards to placements, internships, work experience opportunities. And those, in a sense, kind of act as, I guess you could say, a gateway to that kind of space where you do get that experience with a kind of lesser pressure of having the know-how to implement your skills in that space. I will move on to the next question. And these are, we've got two in a row, and they're both from quite different perspectives, so this will be really interesting. Tyrese, one of our graduate mentors of BDR Group, asked, as a manager younger than their direct reports, what is the best way of earning respect and having colleagues understand that you are the decision maker?
Yes, I feel the pain of this because in my current role as CEO, I am one of the youngest on my team. And again, I'm working with an amazing executive team who have all, some of them have been in work twice as long as me. And, I have to get them to trust that the decisions that I'm making are the right ones. So I completely get this. And again, we can see this not just, early to early stage career. We can see this across our career, right? We can see this in many, many ways. So brilliant question. And a lot of this is to do with credibility in action. And, first of all, it always comes back to, does the manager in question, whoever you are, do you back yourself in your decisions? Yeah. Okay, because if you back yourself and you understand why you're making this decision, then, that's half the battle. The other side of it is really about communication. So often where things go wrong in organizations, it's because we forget about the one key part of communication, which is the why. As managers and as leaders, we often know exactly, we've got this whole thing mapped out in our minds. It's so clear to us why this is happening. And we forget to tell other people why. Okay, so there's a few things. So first of all, backing yourself in your own decision making is key. Secondly, being clear with others as to why this decision is being made is important. And thirdly, where you can and where it's reasonable to do so, bring other people into that decision-making process with them. But, again, there are times when you have to say, because I said so. And, being able to step into those moments with confidence as well, especially, it's so easy. And I get this, I'm in this role. It's so easy for people to sit down and go, well, I wouldn't have done it that way, And it's like, well, Yeah. So, we talk a lot about authentic leadership. We talk a lot about kind of management skills. So a lot of this is around self-compassion. You will make mistakes. You will choose the wrong things. Other people will be so quick to tell you you've done that. But, again, just thinking about what, when and why will you bring other people into that decision-making process? And when and why will you just make those decisions? So a lot of this is to do with trust. It's to do with credibility. It's to do with your own confidence and skill set. And again, thinking about how can you use your team? And a manager's job, while of course we get the day-to-day done, a manager's job is to also enable that team to do their best work. So again, if you have, that going back to that very first question, if you have a diverse skill set around you, that can help you make the best decision. Why wouldn't you draw on those, on that, you know? And so again, get rid of that myth, because I'm a manager and because they know more than I do about this job, this industry, you know, all pressure's on me. Absolutely flip that on its head and go, right, we're all in this together. What do you all think? I will make the final decision. But share your knowledge, share your expertise with me. And it's amazing how when people feel listened to, respect rises. You know, yeah. When they feel genuinely listened to, respect will rise.
Yeah, brilliant. So the next question, like I said, this is a little bit kind of opposite to the question that we've just had. So Tony of Dynamics Consultants asked, as someone who is approaching retirement age and has been in the IT business since 1976, now working with apprentices straight out of school, what would be the best methods of communicating?
Brilliant question. Well, you know, what amazing changes and journey Tony has been on, I'm sure. So in terms of communication, organizations are going to have their own ways of doing this. So, you know, there's do's and there's don'ts in terms of communication across. I was taken by your slides at the beginning, Georgia, where you said, you know, and if you have any more questions, DM, you know, and I was like, yeah. Going, gosh, there's so many on my team that would go, sorry, what's a DM? You know, and, you know, it's funny how in our own worlds and what we bring into our roles, we can get really comfortable with our, you know, with our shortcuts because of what we're so used to. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
So what we're finding organizations are spending a little bit more time on is organizational communication. You know, what as an organization do we think effective communication is? So, you know, you'll get very, very obvious examples. You get really long emails that won't get read. Doesn't work. Okay. If that doesn't work, well, you know, what do we need to do instead? So, you know, how, if you're training and if you're working with people at different levels, there can be a great learning in this is to actually start that open conversation about what works for you in this space. You know, how do I know that the time I'm spending with you is actually of value because what I'm saying is making sense to you? So unfortunately, again, there's no app for getting this right. There's no technological solution. We have to go back to having conversations with people to go, you know, are we hearing the same things? Are you understanding the way I'm communicating with you? And to be honest with you, yes, we can have this across generations, but we can have this with just two different mindsets, you know, in terms of how people are programmed to take in information. So, you know, having, again, very human conversations around what works best for you. That, you know, I'm not sure about that because I don't know that I could be effective in that. And what's our middle ground? And while it can seem to take a little time, it's worth it because if you can get your communication right, you know, you're going to move faster and you're going to move further. So the human conversations, you know, communication is all about the human conversations. And it's amazing how, like, you know, my chairman, what am I saying? This is chairman of Robin Park Institute, he's 73. And last week I got him using voice notes, you know, so, and, you know, this is a new world, you know, so we've started to, you know, it's, again, this is like a bit of reverse mentoring that can happen in these situations as well, Tony. So I'm sure, you know, Tony's picking up new things. And his apprentices are picking up new things. And it just means that with every interaction, there's a refinement. You know, our skill sets are renewed. They're refreshed. We have more in terms of how we communicate with people. Yeah, you have to be brave and have the human conversations.
It takes a lot. And I think every question that we've had, it all does really circle back to communication, doesn't it? So it's definitely an invaluable skill. Sasha at Conductor asked, how do you train and develop line managers to manage an intergenerational team? And I think that all kind of really boils down to the support of the organization. What would be your take on that?
If you were to ask me what job I would not like in an organization now, it's a management role. Okay, because it is so complicated to be a manager these days, isn't it? You know, before COVID, it was like, get this done and we find a way to do it. Since COVID, the expectation that people have across the generations, but mainly from, you know, kind of the last three. So if we go Gen Z, we go with the millennial, like that kind of group. But you have a group in the middle as well. You've got Gen X in the middle as well that really like flexibility, you know. The more traditional workers, your baby boomers, your silent generation at the top, yeah, they'll get back to work, okay, because that's what they're programmed to do. There is an expectation on managers that COVID has placed that you are not only in charge with the tasks, you are in charge with the care of the people. Now, I know management should always be about that. However, we're bringing more of ourselves into the workplace. And so not only different intergenerational complexities, but also just life coming into the workplace as well. So a manager's role has become extremely complicated. And we did a piece of research on this quite recently in Roffey Park. And one of the big challenges that managers are facing is understanding when they can make decisions about things and when they cannot make decisions about things. And when it comes to their team, you know, managers really need autonomy to set their team up to really enable diversity to be a positive part of the work and not a blocker, as we said earlier, are not something that gets in the way of work being done. So managers need more training. Managers need more understanding in what, how do I capitalize on difference because it's going to bring value to the whole team? How do I create an environment where people can be themselves, bring themselves and get the work done? How do I communicate in different ways? Because sometimes I just need to talk to somebody for 5 minutes and I need them to hear me in that 5 minutes, you know. So there is more training, and the challenge with your management. So if maybe you are a manager, or maybe you know the teams, if you can think of them in your mind, the challenge with getting managers out is that they never have time for training because they've got so many plates spinning. But again, unless we can give them the break, allow them to step back a little bit and really understand for themselves, what are they being challenged by? So when they look at their team and they see these different generations and they see these different age groups, if I were to survey 10, 20 managers, you'd have a different range of challenges. So it's not a quick fix. And we need to understand, your managers need to understand what skills they have in terms of working with this team and what's really challenging them. Sometimes it can be about stopping or correcting an older member of the team because they might not feel right at that. Sometimes it might feel like they want to kind of push in a different direction, somebody else on the team, but they don't know how to communicate that message across. So what are the specific management challenges? There's obviously the broad stroke ones are to do with communication. They're to do with prioritization, task management, delegation. They're always the good ones that management training can focus on. But when you're thinking about the complexity of management and all the asks that managers have, it's worthwhile actually really understanding if we could change one thing about your management practice, what would it be that would have the biggest impact? And sometimes that's where we need to start with an organization. Again, it's back to our first point. We've got to understand the problem we have in order to really get a solution that's going to work. But it's not going to happen by osmosis. There's going to have to be conscious thought, effort and training put into this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, this kind of next one leads on quite nicely in terms of maybe some kind of support tactics for younger or more junior members of staff. But Sophia from Publicis Group asked, what support would you recommend as a priority for entry-level talent during their first kind of few weeks? It goes back, I know it sometimes can feel like it's almost a little bit repetitive, but I think this gives us scope to explore a little bit more. But there's definitely scope for this question.
Yeah, oh, for sure. So, again, in the first few weeks, what's going to be of most benefit? What do we need to be able to navigate our organizations and to understand our role? So, again, understanding how the organization communicates, because it's different. And, came from animation. They had their own language. I come into Roffey Park. The first thing we do is we try and get an acronym for everything. Like, if we could just speak in letters, we would. From the outside world coming into that, people are like, what is going on here? Makes perfect sense to us, So there's a language there's a rhythm to every organization, and you know, helping people to understand how to get into that rhythm, how to learn that language and use that language in confidence so that communication just makes more sense. I would love to be very open and say, imagine if we got rid of all of that stuff, but yeah, organizations are too busy to be that mindful. So, you know, how can we help? Absolutely, help with communication, help to understand that, help to understand the real authority that people have. Okay, so often in a new role, you're learning it, you're learning your place, but we generally have a little bit more scope than we might think. And as somebody coming from, you know, younger generation, less experienced, you know, really helping them to understand, you know, what space they have around them to make their own decisions, to be autonomous, you know, to reach out. But one of the key things that's being talked about in the literature, and I really agree with this, is helping new people to build their network from the start. And that network should comprise people from all generations across different business areas, so that when they, you know, they might not know why they need that person in their network now, but there can be a time where they go, do you know what? I need somebody who's been through this before, and it's none of my peers. It's somebody else in the organization. So, you know, helping with network, helping with communication, and helping with understanding their own autonomy, their own agency, it's critical. And sometimes we overlook it.
Yeah, agreed. I think in terms of kind of taking note of the many, many different roles that the attendees in this discussion have with us today. So acquisition advisors, HR leads, careers consultants. Is there anything that you think should be kind of a standard, I guess, that we should have in order to prepare our managers and leaders that rely on us for these types of conversations and changes that might come from having a diverse generational team?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. I think helping all managers around intergenerational diversity. So we used to do quite a lot in Singapore, and this was really common, really common. However, organizational culture and culture was so strong that the difference was a lot less, because the culture really impacted how those generations worked. You know, there was a lot of conformity. In organizations in the UK, in Europe, and in other parts of the world, there's an expectation of, you know, initiative and innovation and, you know, belonging to come out in very different ways. So depending on the nature of your organization, because I imagine there's many on the call that have, you know, this challenge in different geographical regions, which won't be fixed with the same solution, you know. So really helping managers to understand themselves, first of all, what is the value set of my team? Because when the manager sees it, it's much easier for them to understand and to help communicate that to the team members. If the manager's not even thought of it, or if the manager's going, I'm so exhausted trying to manage all of this difference that I can't see the good in it. Just give me five people that are all the same, because my, you know, it'll just be easier. And of course it would be, but that's not the point. The point is that you want the best people in the best roles so that they can do their best job. So a manager's job is to be able to understand, what is it that my team have? What are the skill sets, and what's that combination that when I put them together, I know I'm going to get, you know, X, or I know I'm going to get Y, or I will absolutely not put that combination together because it's just not going to work right now. So a manager really needs to understand, you know, from an emotional intelligence perspective, from a skills perspective, looking at that whole, the holistic nature of the team. But it has to start with the manager, and the manager also has to understand the manager's influence on this team and how this team works. So if I'm a very nervous manager or apprehensive because I'm not sure how to manage, the team are going to pick that up. You're leaking all the time. So how managers understand themselves, their own biases, their own assumptions about the team, and potentially, you know, how we might challenge those assumptions in order to come out with a different outcome.
Brilliant. That's a fantastic kind of perspective, I think a lot of people will see the value in that kind of takeaway. We're going to move slightly more towards hybrid working now. So yes, we're kind of in the last phase. And I think this in itself is just, it's so, so huge. Like you mentioned earlier, it's impacted absolutely everyone from every corner of the world, actually, quite frankly, in terms of hybrid working and the changes that that's had on every single business. One particular question that I think is a really great one is from Adela Pike from ProForest, and they asked, how can we manage peaks and lows of project work which might require overtime when younger generations are resistant to commit to such kind of overtime within their business?
Interesting. I would love to know more about this question, because, you know, again, how are we asking for work to be done? So I'm assuming that there are people probably on the call that say that might not be such an issue for the younger workers I have, as in it's not always a broad stroke trait that we see. So I suppose resistance to and commitment, you know, one of the big trends in research is looking at work ethic across generations and values across generations within the workplace. So, you know, traditionally, again, the silent generation, that's the oldest generation we find in the workplace, and the baby boomers, the next one. Traditionally, work ethic very high, commitment very high, you know, civil service, I'm in this for life, this is my company, this is what I do, and I will do what I'm asked. At other generational levels, there's a different work ethic. Now, I'm not saying that that's not seen, but, you know, generally speaking, there's also different values.
Yeah.
There's different values is, you know, thinking about, actually, I need work-life balance versus, you know, I will do whatever this organization needs me to do. So understanding the value system of the people that you're attracting into your organization is going to be key, because and sometimes I've seen organizations fall into this trap themselves. They've told beautiful stories about flexibility and work-life balance. They've told those stories.
Yeah.
And in reality, it's like, well, actually, no, you not this week. You know, I need you to do this. And so sometimes employees rebel because this is not what you sold me.
Yeah.
You know, and is that right? So in some cases, you know, if you've got somebody constantly saying no to you, you could have a performance issue on your hands rather than this being a generational piece, you know, but really outlining at the forefront. And, you know, there's always time to go back. It's not always ideal, but understanding the requirements and laying out the expectations comes back to communication. What are we asking our staff to do at every level? What expectations does this organization have? And this is where leaders can be useful and can be really detrimental.
Yeah.
Because we always know people look up. And so if they see, you know, as a different example, if they see emails going at night, if they see messages coming at the weekends, the message those leaders are sending is you're supposed to be working all the time. Now, for particular people, arguably, you know, correct, but I'm not signing up for that. I never signed up for that. And you're not going to get me to do that now. So part of it could be attitudinal, in which case, you know, going to have those conversations. Part of it could be a mismatch of values. And again, we're going to need to understand that more. And part of it can be, we haven't explained how this works properly. We've assumed it's just going to be okay. So again, a number of things coming in. And there's always somebody on the team, no matter how busy they are, they'll just do a few. And you're like, oh, I'd like 10 of you. If I could have 10 of you.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have to deal. But, you know, again, this is diversity.
Yeah.
This is diversity. And diversity is going to require much more understanding, much more conversations, you know, and really more, I don't mean negotiations in that kind of win-win situation, but I mean negotiation conversations so that we can really understand the positions that we're in as employee and employer.
Yeah, I completely agree. Tammy, thank you for your contribution to the chat. Tammy's elaborated, saying, I think over time is a question of ownership. How can we encourage more junior members of the team to really own their projects, take responsibility for them, and hence show commitment to delivering them, which might include overtime?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great question. And we work with managers quite a lot on this. Because again, sometimes managers are brilliant for creating that space for junior members to step into, to have a go, to get some things right, to get some things wrong, and for it to be okay. We've also worked with managers who have created that space and watched people fall on their faces and then given out to them for it. You know, so managers really can play a key role in terms of helping set people up right for their next stretchy challenge.
Yeah.
But just not letting go. Like just help through that stretchy challenge, yeah. Because it's only through confidence. I mean, we learn so much when we're put into those situations where we have to be accountable, where we have to be responsible. But certainly what I have seen in my work is the culture of the organization is key for this. So if fear, if deception, if that is how the predominant, like if there's a toxic organizational culture, no one is going to want to own anything, because if you get it wrong, you know, you're going to get screamed at, and it doesn't matter what age or generation you're belong to, you know, you understand this. So accountability and ownership is going to come much more easily, whether it's on a team or whether it's in an organization, that really allows people to have a go, to learn from that, you know, and be supported through that stretchy phase.
Yeah. And I mean, it all really comes back. I know that, when we had our kind of discussions before this, we were talking about kind of the role of management in that situation, and actually how management has changed so much throughout hybrid working, that you may have had kind of a manager that's really got a very strong open door policy that might not know how to kind of translate that to a hybrid working environment. And others that have adapted to it really well and have managed to kind of encourage, maybe, or had an easier time encouraging younger generations to utilize the platforms that we have in place to keep that channel of communication open. And where actually maybe there's some more struggles with kind of older generations who maybe aren't as confident using technology, or don't feel that there's kind of the personal level that encourages you to open up about some kind of issues that you might be struggling with. What would your suggestions be for kind of remediating that on both ends?
So I suppose there's three generations to think about in this. You know, what we understand from research is those that benefit most from in work face to face.
Yeah.
Okay. So they benefit least from online. Okay.
Yeah.
Are those at the top end of their career, so those in the last stage of their career, because they have always done business face to face. They know how to do this. They're experts in this. They value relationships. Okay.
Yeah.
The new members of staff, so the new recruits, because how do you learn about an organization if you never really experienced it?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So And how do you build that network and all of these skills that you really need to thrive in your career? How can you have that? And of course, you know, I know that there's organizations that always will disprove this rule, but there's a very critical generation as well. And that is parents in the middle, or carers, people within those generations. So could have people who are caring for, whether it's children or caring for parents, and you see that parental group. Now, a report came out this morning on this here in Ireland, and it was reported on, and it was to say that if you don't have flexibility for this generation, these generations, you're going to lose them from the workforce, and we're going to go backwards. Okay, right. So if hybrid goes away for this people who are in this part of their life, you are at risk of losing your talent. Because they now understand how to be flexible. In some cases, they're only back in the workplace because of the flexibility that hybrid allowed.
Yeah.
So, you know, so when you think about generations, you think about those ages, you think about life stages, you've got people for whom hybrid and flexibility is what's allowing them to work. You know, so again, thinking about the generations, there's going to be challenges at every know, regardless of generations, which generation you belong to, there will always be challenges, and something new will come in, some new process, some new policy, some new platform. It's going to cause us to be uncomfortable. It's going to cause us to go backwards, go forwards. So there's always going to be these challenges, but there's these big warning signs from across the world that are going, be careful of how you treat particular generations and particular life stages, because you could be just sending your talent out the door. So you got to help those that need that face-to-face time. You've got to help those that are at either end, and you've got to help those that really are benefiting from a balance between being at home, being able to work online, and being face-to-face as well, because it's a key part of so many organizations' demographics that you could just be saying goodbye to.
Absolutely.
In pursuit of another agenda.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I mean, I think we've probably only got just about enough time to cover one more question. I think we may have touched on this slightly, but it would be good to see if there's anything that you can add. What are the key benefits of using a flexi benefit scheme for attracting, recruiting, and retaining individuals from intergenerational talent pools?
Yeah, so again, the research is telling us right now that where flexibility is offered genuine, yeah, where it's part of, you know, you see it in the job, you see it on LinkedIn, yeah, you know, you see more recruitment, more applications for flexible roles. Okay, so employees still want flexibility. Now, I heard the term, what was it called? The return to office agenda or something like that. I think that's going to be the new buzzword for HR and OD to deal with.
People are trying
to get people back, you know?
Yeah.
However, you know, if work can be done in a hybrid way, and if it makes sense to do so for the organization, then, you know, you've got to understand in this change, what's the gain? What's the gain for the people? What's the gain for the clients? What's the gain for the organization? And what will we lose through the change? So, you know, I'm working with so many organizations right now that are really trying to get their model right. And there's so many organizations that I know of that were waiting for this to get a title, which is the return to office agenda. Now it has a title. Now it's a thing. Now I'm happy because everyone is coming back. There is going to be a cost to that. There is going to be a cost to that. And, you know, again, so what we know is employees still want flexibility. It's their number one. And in fact, the research report, I can't remember the name of it offhand, but they said that it's not the perks, it's not the money, it's the flexibility. Now, if employees are saying that, that is a powerful message for organizations to ignore.
Yeah, agreed completely. And at the risk, isn't it, of if you do follow that, I mean, one of the takeaways from the panel, as I mentioned the other day, we were at the student recruitment survey launch. One of the takeaways from a public sector organization was that they have always had in-person work. The only time, and they made it very clear before going hybrid, that they would return straight after to the in-office work. And it was all about authenticity and just owning it. If it's ingrained in your values that the business runs in that way and it runs well, then owning that will still attract the right candidate for that role. So I think that's a massive takeaway. I think we are kind of coming to the end of our time. It's been incredible. I think we've got some really, really great, very clear takeaways there. So thank you so much for your time, Arlene. I think, as I mentioned at the beginning, Arlene has kindly offered her time over the next kind of 24 hours for any additional questions. So if there is anything that sparks in your mind shortly after we say goodbye today, please do utilize the LinkedIn forum. Dan and I will keep an eye on that as well. And we can always kind of feed on from that. Just before we go, we do have a GRN winter social coming up. So it's on the 16th of December from 6 till 8. I have just noticed on this topic, we do have a QR code here. So for any of you that aren't kind of familiar with these, please do get in touch either on LinkedIn or by email, and we can share those details with you. We'd love to see as many of you there as possible for a nice relaxed evening with some colleagues within the industry. Massive thank you. If you need graduates for RPO or volume recruitment projects, you can always reach out to me. These are my details. And again, if you would like any additional information from today, please do let me know. We will be sharing the recording of this email, of this webinar, sorry. So if you do have any other questions or follow-ups, just use the details on the screen. But thank you very much, Arlene. It's been really a pleasure to have you on today. So yeah, take care, everyone. Thank you so much for joining. Thank you. Bye. Thank you.